Tired of the hassle and risks of manual fruit cutting? Let me introduce our partners over at Supercut System, the automated solution that enhances safety, quality, and efficiency. Cut up to 120 perfect citrus wedges per minute, 6 times faster than manual. Patented technology delivers consistent slices, reducing waste and eliminating plastic. The contactless hygienic design lowers contamination risk and workplace injuries. Supercut integrates seamlessly for any volume, improve profitability and customer experience. Experience the power of automation with Supercut. Get started today at supercut.com and be sure to ask about their risk-free trials.
Elevate your dining experience with Rack Porcelain USA. As the exclusive tableware brand for the Walk and Talk podcast, Rack combines exceptional craftsmanship with innovative design. Whether you're a chef, a restaurant owner, or a food enthusiast, Rack's high-quality porcelain products will enhance every meal. Discover the artistry of food presentation and make every dining occasion special. Visit RackPorcelain.com today and see how Rack can transform your table. Chefs and food buyers, let me tell you about a product that will generate new excitement on your menu. Fully cooked, pasture-raised, all-natural Australian lamb from Aussie Select. Their award-winning, handcrafted, innovative products are blended with the finest spices and amazing flavors. Options include agave rosemary, tikka masala, lamb pastrami, and lamb prime rib roast. Available sliced or whole with a long shelf life too. Find out more at AussieSelect.com.
I think, okay, that's enough. So I take the bread out. I put it in a basket. I put it in the pass, and the chef takes it. He looks at it. He squeezes it, and he whips it at me, and it hits me right on the chest, bounces out. And he says in broken English, "Did it hurt?" And I said, "No." He's like, "That's because you didn't cook it enough."
Hello, food fam. This is the Walk and Talk podcast, where you will find the perfect blend of food fun and cooking knowledge. I'm your host, Carl Fiadini. Welcome to the number one food podcast in the country and the official podcast for the New York, California, and Florida restaurant shows, the Pizza Tomorrow Summit, and the U.S. Culinary Open at NAFM. We're recording on site at Ibis Images Studios, where food photography comes alive, and I get to eat it. Email us to learn more. info@thewalkandtalk.com. Today's guest, Chef David Reyes, brings a story rooted in resilience, passion, and relentless creativity. Growing up in Chicago's Humboldt Park neighborhood, David found early purpose in the kitchen, inspired by his grandmother's unforgettable hospitality. After serving as a medic in the Army, David shifted gears and followed his love for cooking, traveling through France, Spain, and Italy to sharpen his craft. His journey took him through stages at legendary kitchens throughout the Chicago area to building restaurants from the ground up across the country. Today, Chef Reyes is driving culinary innovation at St. Pete Distillery, blending his fine dining roots with an exciting new frontier, craft spirits. Rooftop restaurant projects and experiential dining, his story is one of grit, vision, and a deep love for bringing people together through food. Man, I'm excited. We had something today in this kitchen that was happening.
Glad you enjoyed it.
Man, Chef, welcome to the program. Finally.
Yeah.
We are here.
Right.
Yes.
We've been talking about this for years.
For years and a half a dozen times today leading up to this. It's pretty, you know, for people out there who think they want to start a podcast or get into broadcasting and whatnot, let me tell you something. It isn't easy. Nothing is easy. It's fun. Don't get me wrong. The equipment, the lights, the cameras, the action.
Yeah. A lot of prep.
A lot of prep. And then you get the giggles. And what happens? It falls apart 6 times in a row.
Oh my gosh. And that's the fun part.
Indeed. And for those, if you don't know what I'm talking about, normally I run through opening monologue with the precision of a, I don't know what, but.
Surgeon.
A surgeon. But today, no, today was fun. Just say it like that. I'm probably going to laugh throughout this whole episode. All right, before we jump into, you know, who you are, where you came from, let's talk about the food, baby. You brought the heat today. What do you got?
Two dishes, both I've had a lot of fun with throughout my career. The dish that we featured first, the mango soup, is something that when I came across it, I was a young cook carving my way through kitchens in Mexico, and the immediate thought was, this is good, but I think it could be better. Throughout my career, it's had a lot of evolutions, and I featured it on plenty of menus in different formats, and you know, today's was the latest. Glad you enjoyed it. It definitely represents a lot of the flavors that I'm comfortable with. You know, the beauty behind using subtle acids in combination with a lot of other subtle flavors to make sense out of a nice dish.
I thought it was wonderful because you did, you know, I say it a lot. Oh, you taste the layers, but you do.
Yeah.
And it's really great. You know, the citrus, the ceviche, like everything just really, really tied together wonderfully.
Yeah. You know, the latest addition to that was influence from cooking at Haiku and concentrating on a lot of Asian ingredients, fish sauce. I absolutely love fish sauce. It's such a broad spectrum fish sauce, and it's largely misunderstood. So, you know, that was one of those subtleties in that mango soup that made a lot of sense, that brought a savory factor to the table. The second dish was our award-winning dish that we brought to the Tampa Bay Wine and Food Festival, which was a lot of fun, happened 2 weeks ago. Talk about an event that brings the culinary world together in Tampa that's done a great job of doing that. So what I wanted to do was dig into my past and bring out some things that I was very comfortable with. And I shared with you something very intimate that I don't think I would say to a lot of people. And now we're going to put it out on a podcast. A lot of times, and I don't know how this is going to sound, but a lot of times I'll formulate a dish and I won't taste it until we're serving it. And I know a lot of the components will make sense. I've had them in different combinations in the past. And this is one of those dishes. This is one of those dishes where I'm like, in my head, it all just makes sense. It tasted real good. Every component tasted real good. It wasn't until the day of that we're doing samples of these bites for the public that I put the whole thing together. And I was so happy. I was really excited. We had played with the plate up, didn't even taste it then. And then we took it on stage, put it together, and we won. So we were very proud of it.
There's a lot to unpack with that.
Yeah.
I think that once you hit a certain place in your chefdom, you kind of know what's going to work. I mean, you should be tested. I mean,
everything should be tested.
Yeah. I'm not discounting that at all, but you're going to know, like, this is going to pair well with that. And this should go well with this and yada down the road. Right.
Right.
Yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But then at the end of it, you're winning competitions like that. That's where it's funny. That's where it gets a little bizarre.
It does.
Right?
And it's not the first time it's happened. I don't know. Again, I don't know how that's going to sound, but it's not the first time that it's happened. It's, you know, been multiple times during specialty dinners, you know, a wine pairing or a drink pairing. And, you know, I conceptualize this whole thing in a bite, in a morsel, and it all just makes sense in my mind. Really don't wait. I don't find out that it works until the day of. And luckily, it does.
The only people that's going to bother are the people who come in second, third, and fourth. Do you understand?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
So if you're listening, second, third, and fourth, you know, there you go. Like, you know, don't eat your heart out of it.
Right.
Well, I don't want to make any enemies.
No, yeah. That second dish, I got to tell you, the core of it is one of my favorite dishes to prepare. That to me, when I first tasted it, was a complete surprise. I was in Puerto Vallarta. I was working at a really nice hotel. And one of the sous chefs brought forth this dish that he had prepared with his family. And it was basically a snapper wrapped in banana leaf with plantain. That was the core of the dish, right? I added bacon grease to that and like a few other elements. That became a restaurant dish. That's the core of the dish that we serve today and that we won that competition with. So there's a lot more to it. It's not something that I just dreamt up. You know, there's some history there. So yeah, we were very proud of it, but I literally had not tasted the whole combination until the day of.
And you saw the photography.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I can't wait to post.
Geeked about, yeah, what I saw. So
let's talk Humboldt Park.
Yeah.
1980s. That's where you're from. Can you describe that?
Yeah. You know, those are the kind of things that you don't realize are exceptional until you're far from it. I remember early in my career, I was at a table with the owner of a hotel that I was working at. And he asked me the question, tell me about your upbringing. Tell me about growing up. And I said, well, I grew up in a inner city Chicago, in a deep in the, on the west side of Chicago, on the northwest side of Chicago. And growing up, I didn't spend a lot of time outside. I wasn't allowed to. There's a lot of things going on in the neighborhood that were unsavory. And my, I guess my parents wanted to protect me from shootings, stabbings, a lot of, the fact that I brought up that I saw my first dead body at like 6 years old, that I looked up and everybody had was wide-eyed and incredulous. I thought to myself, well, that might be a little weird. You know, that might be odd. And there was other things that, that you know, looking back, coming up, you know, in grade school and having shootings outside across the street and thinking to myself, well, I guess that's going to cut recess short. Not really focusing on the fact that there was a shooting outside, you know, or a drive-by and things like that, you know, unfortunately were kind of normal. And, you know, again, you don't realize how exceptional they are until you look back. That certainly helped shape the way I approach what I do.
Chef, growing up inner city is a little different. And while I can identify with a little bit of what you have going on there, me growing up in Brooklyn for 5 years as, you know, a child, I've seen my share of stuff. It sounds to me, though, this really had something to do with the shaping of who you are now and who you became.
Yeah, it certainly, you never forget things like that. You know, it makes it so that you can find a commonality with any group. You know, growing up inner city, you're surrounded by people that, you know, sometimes a few generations into that neighborhood and that style of living. And, you know, you're comfortable with that. You're comfortable. You can make things relative. But then transitioning into this world of fine dining and finding a way to relate to guests that have a much higher expectation, a much higher, you know, let's say education, class, whatever you want to call it, and finding commonality there has been something that I think I've strived with. You know, I've always been able to relate to anybody that I'm working with or talking to, and whether we're talking about fine watches or things that happen in inner city Chicago.
Roots and hospitality is really what you're getting into. And if you look at it, you have the rough upbringing on one hand, but on the other, you have your grandmother.
Right.
Why don't you go ahead and explain a little bit how maybe she might have softened the edges for you a little bit.
Yeah, being surrounded by family was certainly an influence in my career. Early on, I had to decide what inspired me to be in the culinary world, what inspired me to be in the restaurant business. And I quickly identified sitting at my grandmother's table as something that I wanted to convey to other people. And that was a feeling of nothing is missing, because you would sit at her table and she would literally bring everything to you. Some things were in like little separate dishes. It was very Spanish style serving. And whether you wanted anything to drink, any utensil, it was an insult to get up and want something. She was insulted. She would be like, what are you doing? You know, I'd be like, Grandma, I have to use the bathroom. Relax. You know, so it was that feeling of there's nothing missing at this particular moment. The company was always good, of course. And my mother also conveyed that feeling as well. But, you know, it certainly was something that I felt that's what I want to convey to other people. Is this wonderful feeling of there's nothing missing, you know, getting up from the table and feeling absolutely satisfied. Like there, you could have done nothing to make that better. And so that is a very special feeling, you know, take into account, you know, cooking with my mother, cooking with my father growing up was also a thing. We didn't eat out much. You know, I joke and say, you know, we'd be able to go to McDonald's if we got good grades. So I basically never went to McDonald's. Things like that. It was true. We really never ate out. We always ate in. It was, you know, we weren't, you could say we had humble beginnings. You know, my father was blue collar. We were a blue collar family in a very inner city part of Chicago. You know, it was great for me. I mean, I love the way we grew up despite all the challenges.
When you're talking about Spanish heritage or Italian heritage, the first and second generations typically have a similar upbringing. And into that third, everything starts to change. I feel like that, like your parents, my parents, our grandparents, they're built different. They were different. They were a different breed of individuals.
I'd absolutely agree. I mean, the tenacity, you know, to do what my parents did, come here as immigrants, establish citizenship, work their tails off, buy a house, buy another house, put kids through private school in that neighborhood. Like, I look back and I think, man, I can't see myself doing that. Like, I just, to you'd have to have a really good job. You know, my dad never stopped working hourly. You know, he wasn't never a salaried guy. My mother worked for the Archdiocese of Chicago for almost half her life, you know, cooking and cleaning. And but to accomplish what they did, I'm forever grateful, you know. And I look back and I think that was really, that's a lot of tenacity.
To me, the essence of a show, a podcast, broadcast, whatever, I think in the spirit of folks who become chefs or live in this food industry, the stories of the families, I think, are one of the most fascinating aspects of all of this. Because what drives somebody to go into the food business is beyond me.
You want to know something really funny? When I decided that I wasn't going to go through and continue my medical career, and I announced to the family that I was going to culinary school, a lot of my family members were so disappointed. They were like, why would you do that? Don't do that. Don't change what you're doing. And it was funny to me because I didn't expect that. But, you know, the more time I spent in the culinary world, in the restaurant world, I was like, oh, that's what they're referring to. Like, it's tough. It's a grind. It's a, you know, at the end of the day, it's a trade, right? There's artistry to it. And that's one of the things that I absolutely love, but it's a trade. You have to make sense out of everything.
When I talk about it, I say I did 10 years in the food business on the restaurant side. Like, it's a prison sentence.
Right.
Because it's kind of that. You know, it is great when you're young and you're doing that work and you're making money and it's a kind of a, it's a bit of a fast life. You know, everybody goes out afterwards. You're up until 6 a.m. and you're doing all that stuff. And there's like a camaraderie to it. It's fun. There's something to it. And you learn a lot out of that. If you make it out on the other side, there's a lot of really positive lessons. The problem is a lot of us don't.
Right.
And you know, it is a rough life. You know, if it were... Like, I would tell my kids, I would say, look, because they're still young, you're going to work at a restaurant for 1 year and you're going to do some stuff in the back and you're going to do some stuff in the front and then you're out. I want you to experience what it is to deal with the public when they're hungry.
Sure.
And because of that, it's the chain reaction that just is, it just goes all the way from the hostess to the server, to the bartender, to the line cook, to the GM, to the F&B director, to whoever it is. Everybody feels what the guest puts out there.
Right.
And it all stems from the guest,
right,
and the service that you have to give to that,
right,
guest.
Right.
Right. Or else it would be easy. Who cares?
Yeah. Most of us spend the bulk of our career burning the candle at both ends. You know, and it takes a toll on a lot of us. I think it takes a toll on everybody. It's just whether what we do with it is what makes the difference, right? And certainly I was very proud of how I started my career. A lot of things that I did before I got deep in the restaurant business came into play. Being in the military, growing up around food, being surrounded by intense flavors, growing up eating home-cooked meals all the time, all that played influence on the start of my career, and I noticed that. And I would step very carefully. Every step of the way, I wanted to make sure it was thought out, there was purpose, there was a trajectory. I never started something without the end in mind. The way I've kind of preceded everything I've done, you know, I can't say it's all been perfect, but it's certainly been extremely interesting and fun.
Well, let's talk military discipline in the kitchen. You served as a medic in the Army before, you know, getting into the restaurant world.
Right.
Based on our pregame conversation, mm-hmm, you know, there were some pressures that influenced, again, who you are today.
Right.
You gave up a career Possibly medicine.
Right.
I was going to say that. Hold on, let me say that.
Because that's where, that's my idea was, I want to get into medicine, right? When I left, there were so many things that came into play. One of them was staying calm, right, in the face of adversity. I remember one time in culinary school, the instructor came up to me and we were in a very intense part of the class and we had to do things that all were very, it was important to be on time and be clean. And you were being very, everybody was observing you. The instructors were very observant. And he goes up to me, he's like, "You seem to be calm. Why?" And I go, "Well, chef, no one's going to die today, right? It's all just food." And he's like, "Huh, okay." He walks away, and I thought, well, it didn't seem exceptional to me, but I guess it is. And, you know, that's the beauty of what we're doing. As intense as it may be, you know, it's only our egos that are really on the line. You know, if you do everything with love and intent, you should be all right.
You know what's really funny? When I was younger, I took a detour in life and got into things I shouldn't have been getting into. And when I got out of that lifestyle, I was always looking over my shoulder. I would go to bed, one eye open, you know, the whole thing. And when I left the food business and I started these other ventures.
Right.
And when I was finished with those ventures and I got into, you know, the food distribution and sales part of the business, I would just go cold calling like it was nothing. I was new to outside sales, and right. It was the easiest thing ever. And my sales manager, he said to me one day, he goes, "You're not nervous about this at all." And I'm like, nobody's going to hurt me. Like nobody's out to, you know, they're not going to get me. You know what I mean? It's okay. Like this is the easiest thing ever. I don't have to worry about anything or anybody.
You know? Sometimes the best advocate is what you don't know. You know, that's come into play for me so much. You know, there's been so many fads and trends in the culinary world, and I've never really been heavily influenced one way or another. I pay attention, and I certainly have used it when it's made sense. But the fact of the matter is, nothing will ever replace great flavor. You know, a great ingredients. There is no, you know. I love molecular gastronomy. I play in it. It's not a focal point of my career or any one of my menus. It all just has to make sense. Every fad has come and gone, and what stays is just good food done right.
The happiest things for me are the simplest.
Oh, absolutely.
It's usually in front of a sink, and it's usually a morsel, a bite of something. And I take that little bite and I have that, like, you know, 1,000-yard stare away, and I'm just enjoying whatever it is that I'm eating there.
Yeah.
Come hell or high water around me. Right. I don't even pay attention. I'm literally, the walls can be falling down and I'm just sincerely eating whatever that thing is.
Right.
That's one of my happiest moments, believe it or not. Like I love my kids, my wife, all that stuff. It's great. But when you're talking about like a singular thing, for me, that's what it is. I mean, I fell into the right business, I suppose, for that.
Right. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, simple food can invoke memories, can invoke just passion, and you know, it could make you cry. A good meal can make you cry.
It started with me, and I'll tell you where, with a fresh mozzarella. Mm. As a kid, you know, they would come home, somebody would, you know, go to the store, come back with, you know, the wax paper with a, you know, nice, fresh, juicy, you know, mozzarella, break it out. And I can hear the paper folding, you know, and opening. And then they would get the salt, they put a little salt, slice it up. There was always some tomatoes and basil and oil. And there you are over the sink, just eating this. Is that a meal? No, right. It's just really awesome to eat.
Right.
You know, and yeah, it started there. I know that's where it all began for me. But where it began for you, part of the way, is through your travels.
Right. Yeah. When I left the military, you know, I traveled a little bit, but I kind of left a bug and this want to get out of the norm. Once I discovered there was more to this life than just Chicago, I wanted to see it all, you know, so I did what I could to get out, and using, you know, culinary school as a vehicle under the premise that I wanted to go learn. You know, I traveled through Europe, Southern France, primarily. Southern France, the beauty of Southern France is it's an hour away from Italy and an hour and a half away from Spain. So my days off, I would spend traveling in and out of other countries, which is easy to do when you're in Europe. And any opportunity I would cook. You know, I would take a stage, which back then was still a very normal thing to line up a stage, work somewhere for free just to learn. And most of the time that I spent in Europe was under stages for 2-star Michelin restaurants, 1-star Michelin restaurants. Literally, I would be challenged to the point where they would say, you're going to work the dish, and until you can speak enough French and show that you have the organizational skills to work garmanger, you're going to work the dish. And I would basically take it up as a challenge, learn every French word I could immediately. Couple of phrases. How do you say this in French? Saying that in French was key to learning, you know, a lot more. What is the name of this? All those terms in French were, you know, clutch. So the first day I moved out of the plonge, which is, you know, the dish pit, I was on garmanger, and one of the primary jobs was in a combi oven finishing off bread for bread service. And here I am, the first day I'm finally out of the dish pit, and I'm putting bread. They'd call to, you know, bread service, and in French, everything's in French, you know, and I'd stick 2 pieces of bread in, shut the door, wait for it anxiously. Like, this is the first time I can't wait. And I think, okay, that's enough. So I take the bread out. I put it in a basket. I put it in the pass, and the chef takes it. He looks at it. He squeezes it. And he whips it at me, and it hits me right on the chest, bounces out. And he says in broken English, he's like, did it hurt? And I said, no. He's like, that's because you didn't cook it enough. And I'm like, well, you could have just said it needs to be crispy. Like, okay, got it. So, you know, moving on, things like that happened all the time. There was, when I finally made it past a few more stations onto the main station where you were cooking with the chef side by side, I remember it like it was yesterday. I'm plating my first dish, and I'm thinking to myself, man, am I killing it. This dish looks good. And the chef walks up right behind me, and he looks, and he takes the dish, and he puts it on my chest. Mind you, we were in an open kitchen, so everybody in the dining room could see what's happening. And if you ever got like a smudge of something on you or anything, you'd have to go run to the changing room, which was 2 levels down the street. It was a hotel, and change, and then come right back. And so he made me wear my first plate, and I gripped the plate to my chest nice and tight. And I'm like, I guess it didn't look good enough. He's like, it didn't look good enough. And so I ran with the plate to my chest down to the changing room to change. And it's like, okay, you certainly learn the lesson. You know, you move on. You can't take anything personally. That's not the first time or the last time. And, you know, it's things like that, that how do you convey that? How do you convey that feeling to cooks that you're trying to teach? This needs to be an unforgettable moment, and you can't really shove a plate in their chest or throw bread at them. So you have to come up with creative ways on how to convey ideas.
Wait a minute here. Hold on. I got to stop this for a second. Listen, there's a difference between what that chef was teaching you,
right?
Because that's what that is such a unique way to get your point across. But he didn't throw a knife at you. He didn't take a saucepan and hit you over that. Yeah, like, and I'm not saying they don't do that either. I know that that happens too. Oh, yeah. But something like that, I think, is even today should be absolutely acceptable, because there's nothing that proves the point. And I'm so glad that you explained it. In a kitchen like that, mm-hmm. You get dirty, you got to go, man.
Right.
Didn't he prove a point? You're absolutely wearing the dish. So it's not just that it was a smudge.
No.
You're wearing the whole dish. Right. Yeah. Like, wow. That is like such a metaphor. Like, that's beautiful. Oh, I think everything should be like that.
Well, the idea was, as good as you might think it looked, it could be better. And when I came back, I paid attention, and sure enough, that plate could have looked a lot better. Listen, I've been in kitchens where I'm side by side with another cook or another chef or chef de partie, whatever. And, you know, I'm constantly being told move or move that, move this. And the next thing you know, I'm burned. Like, you know, a pot just grazed my arm conveniently to remind me that I was taking up too much space or I wasn't being aware enough. Sabotage. I mean, that used to be a thing where somebody would crank your heat. You're reducing a sauce for your station and somebody comes up right behind you and they want that position. So they're going to sabotage your station. That was a thing. So how do you take all these violent happenings that happened in the kitchen and convey that to new cooks now in this day and age? So that's a very difficult thing to do. However, there's always a good way to do it. And sometimes it's pretty funny. For example, this was years ago, and I had a problem with a prep crew constantly leave empty boxes in the walk-in cooler. And I'd say the next person to leave an empty box has to wear the box for the rest of the day on their head, no matter what size the box. And I literally had a couple of prep cooks wearing a box on their head for the rest of the day. Guess what? Nobody ever did that again. You know, it was fun, funny, but it was memorable. And just, you know, those are some of the challenges that come with the territory. You know, you can't throw a plate at somebody, but maybe you can put a box on their head.
Michelin restaurants, anywhere on the planet, not an easy place to be, clearly.
Right.
You were in Europe. I'd love to hear some of the names of the places that you were at. And then where did you land when you came back stateside?
One of the other very memorable restaurants is still there. It's in a town called, it is called Tête du Chien, I think. Tête du Chien. It's right above Monaco, between Monaco and Nice. And it literally overlooks Monaco. It's a hotel. It's been there God knows how long. The restaurant is called Le Chef d'Or, which is the golden goat, basically, translates into. Spent some time there. Exceptional pedigree. They put out some amazing food and have taught some amazing chefs that are still, you know, in the industry. I also worked at a restaurant in a small town near Toulouse called Cordes sous Ciel, which is cords in the sky. That's what it translates into because it was pretty high up in altitude. It was a city that had three layers of fortification that was built in 1200 by the Count of Toulouse to hide the Cathars during the Crusade. So there was a lot of history involved there. And so, I mean, talk about exceptional experiences. We would take this, I swear it was like a 2-cylinder little truck into the city to go to the markets, collect everything. And it literally came back so loaded that we would have to meet the truck halfway down because it couldn't make the trek up. And we'd have to push it up. Like literally it's, you know, revving at as high as it could. And it's trying to make this, you know, road that led up to the restaurant. We're pushing it. And by the way, that restaurant was in what would have been referred to as kind of like the castle, but it didn't look like a traditional castle. It looked like a very opulent building. And where we would sit to eat family meal, if you listed that as a restaurant, you'd have people from around the world trying to eat there because the view was exceptional. It was in the garden that we would use for the restaurant, but it would overlook the French countryside. You'd watch sheep kind of just pasture and move from one side of the hill to another. And I mean, it was just gorgeous. And we would have family meal there, you know? So everything was very inspiring there. You would wake up really early. You'd probably stage in the bakery making bread that was later going to get thrown at you. And, you know, then you'd go home, take a nap, do lunch service, go home, take a nap, do dinner service. You literally just live, eat, breathe culinary.
Before you get into Chicago, explain how somebody would work for free just for the experience. Oh, yeah. Because I think a lot of the people who go out and eat don't recognize that, number one. But then number two, you've got the new class of restaurant folks coming through. You know, and I feel like they would appreciate staging, but I think the insurances and the liabilities and everything kind of eats that all up and just murdered it.
Yeah. You know, I think you could say it was about 15 years ago where the stage started to disappear in the culinary industry. It's still alive and well in Europe, different parts of the world, but it's this idea that in exchange for learning and having the unique opportunity to be part of a team for at least a short amount of time, you work for free, you know? And for me, it was room and board. You know, the last restaurant I ever worked at in France was nice enough to give me a check on the way out and say, hey, thank you. We wanted to make sure that you got at least some compensation. And so then I went to go live in London for about a month on that, you know, and literally staged in London because they were able to kind of give me a little bit of change before I left. But anyway, that idea doesn't really exist anymore, at least not the way it used to. You can take on a stagiaire or someone that's kind of trying out for your restaurant, pay a minimum wage if they're willing to do that. But yeah, how do you convey this idea that, okay, you're going to work for me for free for about 2 weeks, and then we're going to decide if we're going to hire you or not based on what we see. And, you know, that's a hard idea to convey. And, you know, even internships, I think, have to be paid now if you're out of culinary school. So that wasn't the case when I was in culinary school, you know.
But even if you didn't get hired, you were thrilled to get the opportunity.
Absolutely.
To get the stage, yeah. Just to say, hey, I have this as a badge.
Right. Yeah, I take this into account. When I first came back from Europe, I walked into some really heavy-hitting restaurants in Chicago and asked them for a stage. People like Paul Kahan, I was lucky enough to run into back when he had Blackbird and did a stage there, spent a few weeks there. And I did a couple of stages at Alinea, both of which were absolutely epic because Alinea to me was the first time I had ever been in a kitchen in the US that reminded me of the essence of what it is to be in a Michelin star kitchen in Europe. You know, because in a Michelin star kitchen in Europe, you can walk in, you're not really sure who's leading that station, that area of the restaurant, because everybody can be mistaken as the chef. They're so just passionate and full of intent that you're just not sure who's actually leading. Everybody's kind of on that same level. And so at Alinea, I mean, you have so many passionate people on a team in a small space that it's impressive that there's that much passion going into everything from dishwashing to, you know, picking through microgreens in the basement or, you know, doing all the things. Like, I remember one of the first tasks I was given was to pick microgreens. And then later that day, I was breaking down Thai dried chili peppers. And I asked, what are we making with this? Sriracha. We're making our own sriracha. I'm like, how could you improve on sriracha? But apparently you can. And, you know, it was that nuanced. That level of attention to detail was exceptional. And that was very inspiring to me. The unfortunate thing at the time, they were going to open a restaurant called Next. And I was game. I was for it. I wanted that position. And I sat down at the table after my stage was done, after a few weeks. And Grant Ackett's at the time, he had a chef de cuisine. His name is David Barron. And they both talked about how I'm the ideal person that would join the team that, you know, they could see the possibility with. But then I come to learn that that job also paid about $30,000 a year. And in 2012, that wasn't going to be enough to get married and have, you know, any sort of quality of life. So it was the hardest job I ever had to turn down. But lessons learned, I loved it. Things that I learned in the kitchen, I still use to this day.
I don't have this in my show notes for today. The bear.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, what are the connections?
I'll be completely brutally honest. Season one, I watched, got through it. I hesitate. I think I stopped after like episode 4 because I'm like, this is triggering. This is like too close to comfort. And I don't necessarily want to do that after I get off a long day. So I haven't kept up with it, but I've gotten bits and pieces of it. It's very close to real life. You know, it's certainly like anything, even cooking shows on TV. There's things that happen. They just don't happen as often as you might, you know, see that conveyed in a show. But yeah, man, it was real. And I love that they really highlighted Chicago very well. They put it in a very good light as it deserved, because I mean, that's a cradle for the culinary industry. I mean, people have grinded their teeth in Chicago and gone off to other parts of the country and done great things. You know, it needed a little boost like that. It was cool.
Yeah, I don't have the level of experience in, at that sort of caliber restaurant. But when I watched the first season, and I also felt a lot of that. I don't want to say triggered, but I felt it. Like I was, my anxiety,
oh, yeah.
I was sweating, you know, watching some of that stuff. And of course, with me, it had more to do with the front of the house activity versus the back of the house. But man, I'll tell you, like the show, if I get moved by a show, I want to watch it.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to, and I did, I binged that entire season, whatever, however many were there, I did it in days.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I binged the whole thing.
The plight of the sous chef was all too familiar. I remember in culinary school getting up at 3 a.m. to make a baking and pastry class at like 5. That was brutal. And then I had to go to the restaurant job that I had after culinary school was done. Like, you know, at, I think it was 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock, I would go work at a restaurant called Red Light on the downtown near the United Center. Anyway, it was a brutal day. You know, the funny thing, here we are 20 years later and I'm still having 14 hour days.
I mean, it's definitely relevant. So we fast forward from the travel, the experiences. Right. Now you're building restaurants from the ground up.
Yeah. So that diverse background kind of led me to be a part of a lot of teams opening up restaurants. I found myself in the position of, hey, you've done that. Why don't you help us do this? Or why don't you help bring a more refined approach to, let's say, bar food, you know? So I found myself on teams opening up restaurants, concepts around Chicago. You know, these were in the early 2000s. And so again, looking back, that was pretty lucky, fortunate, because you learn a lot opening up a restaurant. You learn a lot about what not to do. You make a lot of mistakes, and you know, making mistakes on someone else's dime is pretty valuable. So, you know, I kept restaurant jobs and I would help other people open up different restaurants or even help just be part of the concepting and tasting and testing and whatnot. I eventually found myself as a concept chef for a restaurant group out of Chicago. They had just sold Bar Louie and they were looking to concept a lot of other things that were cutting edge. Kind of high-end bars, different concepts, Mexican, steakhouse. So it was very diverse work, and I was chomping at the bit to take it. And got brought on and immediately hit the road. You know, I think I spent the first two years of my marriage on the road for like 10 months at a time, you know. And you learned a lot because you go into different cities. Every city is a little different when it comes to like health code. And then hiring is different. Job pools are different. You know, you get to learn that it's just a different expectation. So it was a lot of fast learning. And that kind of helped shape what I did for the rest of my career.
How does that transition into the anatomy of a dish?
You learn how to take the anatomy of a dish and make it efficient, you know. Make it so other people can help execute your work. You take apart a dish to a very nuanced level and you break it down to, you know, subtle sub recipes that need that consistency. So, you know, when you're talking reproducing your efforts through other people on a national scale, when you're doing, let's say, 5 different concepts at once, that's an extremely important thing to know how to do well. And a lot of what I did was literally recipe writing, breaking everything down to a level that was easy to understand and then teaching it. I was actually doing very little cooking sometimes. You know, it was a lot of teaching, a little less cooking. And you know, it certainly taught me a lot about the anatomy of a restaurant as well. You know, taking the ideas in a restaurant, breaking them down, standardizing them so that they're much more consistent. So the anatomy of a dish to me has always been something I have a lot of fun with, you know, because I learned so many ways of doing it. And, you know, I wish I would have documented more the anatomy of certain dishes. Like the one that we came up with for that competition, it really started around a table with, you know, 2 other chefs and just throwing ideas out and then sketching something that looked like a bunch of scribbles on a paper, and then taking that and making a more refined sketch, and then a more refined sketch, and then the next sketch had sub recipe lists, and then the next sketch after that was much more words and a lot less images. And, you know, it's something that it's beautiful when you see it happen.
You just defined walk and talk media with that.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, am I right, John? Right. I mean, it started with like, you know, Crayola crayons and a three-year-old, and we've turned it into something really special. Same scenario, same yeah. sort of a anatomy, if you will. It's Tampa Bay. We're here. We didn't come from here, but we're here. Time is a funny thing. St. Pete Distillery. Been around for about 10 years.
Yep.
You've been there for about a year and a half or so.
Right.
You're taking culinary into a whole nother path. Talk about it.
Yeah, it's a unique setting. The distillery sits on a 30-acre lot. It's privately owned. It's the largest privately owned piece of property in St. Pete. We intend to develop it into an important part of the community, really. And part of that is some hospitality, whether it's restaurants, event centers, place where the community can come together. Currently, we do private events. We do something called the dinner series at the distillery, all with this idea of highlighting what we're doing at the distillery. The St. Petersburg Distillery has this very unique approach of highlighting Florida in general in all of its products, uses every piece of cereal grain that enters that distillery comes from Florida, which is very unique in and of itself. We mill there, we bring up fresh groundwater, we filter it, everything we make is with Florida in mind. So joining them, installing hospitality, putting together a program, you know, hosting private events has been a big challenge. And I certainly see a lot more possibility there. And I wish we would grow a lot faster, but, you know, everything will come in time, right? So the dinner series is sort of a placeholder for the future and what we want to do on the 30-acre lot. You know, we have in mind to install this community-oriented restaurant where everything it surrounds a hearth oven and everything is cooked with fire, live fire, you know. So that should be something that hopefully will come up in the next couple of years. But the dinner series is kind of an opportunity for us to flex our culinary muscle and our creativity, you know. And so we take the product that's being made and we work it into recipes, and we do a 6 to 7 course tasting menu that's paired with unique cocktails. Sometimes you're going to eat your cocktail and drink your main dish. Some cocktails are very whimsical. There's a lot of components. There's things that'll be done table side. So it's a unique opportunity, and it's only 20 people at a time. So our intent is to kind of garner enough attention so that when we go to construct that brick and mortar restaurant, it already has a reputation.
Do you have aspirations for any glory? Are you looking for any beard, or are you looking for any Michelin, or is it that level?
It's one thing that I've learned in my career is you never start with that. I mean, yes, it's nice. It's great. Recognition is always great, right? If you're doing what you love to the best of your ability, the attention will come. Shoot, when I returned from Europe, Michelin wasn't even in Chicago yet, you know, so to see the Michelin guide come through and start rating restaurants in Chicago, and you certainly like, okay, that's cool. But is it a goal of mine? No, not necessarily. You know, I certainly admire those restaurants. I admire what they're doing. And, you know, I know, having been in Michelin rated restaurants, that it takes much more than just food or a chef. It takes a multifaceted approach that has to be well thought out. And until I'm ready to do that 100%, then you just do what you love.
You got to get the buy-in from every single yep. person in the house.
Everyone, from start to finish, from the dishwasher all the way to the host to hostess. It has to be from start. The definition of a Michelin star is something worth going out of the way for, right? So if you're not ready to do that, then you have no business playing in that game, right? So my intent right now is to showcase what I'd love to do. If we garner enough attention, great. I love it. But to say that's my goal, no, that'd be a mistake.
You brought a couple of bottles of goodies. We didn't break into them yet. What did you bring?
So I brought two of my favorite things we're making. And one of them is a long time coming. It's a 4-year straight bourbon, 90% corn, 10% rye. It's been barrel aged in new American oak for 4 years. Aging in Florida is definitely very different. The result of it is something very smooth, and that's what you'll find with this bourbon. The other thing that I brought is my other favorite, an agave spirit. What an agave spirit is basically, if we were in Mexico, it'd be a tequila. If we were in Mexico, we'd be going for tacos after this too. So,
no, without question.
Right. So an agave spirit, the agave came from Mexico, was distilled at the St. Petersburg distillery, aged in second use oak, old whiskey barrels, basically. We introduced some charred wood chips to enhance that flavor and that color. The result is this beautiful sipping spirit that I absolutely adore because it reminds me of the way tequila used to be made, right? When we fire roasted the pineapples at the root of the agave plant. And, you know, you fire roasted them to soften them up and get the juices out. And then what you fermented had this smoky tinge to it that was akin to, some might say, mezcal, but it was tequila. It's the way it used to be made, right? It was as clear as vodka, but it had a nice little smoky finish to it. And that's what you get out of this agave spirit, you know? So I absolutely love it. I'll put it up against any other agave spirit or tequila.
You just took my question away. I was going to say, how is this comparing? How are both of those products comparing with, you know, some of the heavy hitters that are out there?
I think the bourbon has found its spot as being this overwhelmingly just smooth, beautiful, well-crafted bourbon that Florida should be proud of. And the agave spirit is just unexpected. It is so, so unexpected. And frankly, you know, I'm a big fan of tequila. I have a small tequila collection. And, you know, again, this reminds me of the way tequila used to be made. Despite not drinking, I still have a memory of taste buds, and I still use my taste buds. But yeah, it's impressive. And anybody that is a fan of tequila definitely falls in love.
What you're saying really is you shouldn't be drinking this out of a solo cup.
Listen, I'm a big fan of drinking out of whatever heck you want, right? But it just tastes better in a heavy rocks glass.
True story. Good. That's a true story. Chef, you're awesome, man. What you did here today was terrific. We're thrilled you came out. How do we find you on socials?
Well, I'm at Chef David Reyes on Instagram and Facebook. The distillery is St. Petersburg Distillery, both of which will always feature the latest of what we're doing and how to get there.
You're going to give us a tour sometime, right?
You know, the funny thing about that is we just started tours. We used to be a production facility only, so we just started tours, and it's definitely worth a drive, definitely going out of the way for to come get a tour, and you'll probably see me there, yeah.
Okay, we're going to put that together. Again, thanks for coming out today. John, let's get these pictures rocking and rolling, baby. I feel like you're getting better every week. Maybe, right?
It's hard to prove. Yeah. It's hard to improve on perfection.
He still doesn't talk. We've been doing this for 2.5 years. He still doesn't talk. All right, guys, listen. Love you both. We are out.
Get ready to innovate and organize your workspace with Metro. As the industry leader in storage and productivity solutions, Metro is here to transform and organize your kitchen. With their premium solutions, you'll experience the Metro difference. Metro's sturdy and versatile shelving units, workstations, holding cabinets, and utility carts are designed to streamline operations and maximize your productivity. Don't settle for imitators. Metro products last longer and offer unparalleled quality and durability. Plus, many customization options ensure that your workspace is tailored to your unique needs. Visit their website or contact them today to start designing your perfect space. Metro Shelving, your partner in organization and efficiency.
Let me tell you about my friends over at Citrus America and their amazing juicing equipment. They're revolutionizing the way you enjoy freshly squeezed juice. They're at the best hotels, restaurants, and markets. Their mission is simple. develop a unique consumer experience with on-premise juicing, deliver healthy taste options to clientele, and juice more faster. It's that easy. Citrus America supplies the highest quality juicing equipment and solutions in the industry. So whether you're a small business owner or a large corporation, Citrus America has the right juicing equipment for you. Find out more at citrusamerica.com.